Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange Eons. Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Yep.
That's Vanessa over there.
Hello.
That makes me Kelly. We are sitting in a lovely hotel room at the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And we realized, we don't have an episode ready for next week, so we better hurry up and do something.
That's right. And it is, as far as hotel room, this is much better than what we're used to staying at when we're down for the Lovecraft, although it does lack the character of the field.
Do you normally stay in the hotel down the road that's missing the M and it looks like no one has ever washed the sign
in
60 Banfield.
Years? The Banfield Motor Inn.
Oh my God, that place looks terrifying.
Eric and I walked into this place and we were like, what? The bathroom door closes all the way? There's no holes in the wall. What is this place?
Nope. So you're telling me that motel was booked out?
No, it's closed for COVID, or they're doing something. Looks like they're doing more renovations or something.
They're probably taking this time to replace the doors that don't close and stuff like that. I don't know. It's been a mainstay for the Lovecraft Film Festival for us, but everyone who stays there just jokes about how awful this place is.
Oh my God.
And they've had the balls then to raise their rates because they know they're the only place within walking distance of the festival.
Oh
so their rates, which are $89 a night, suddenly are $149 during the Lovecraft Film Festival.
It is a hotel I would never stay at, except for the Lovecraft Festival, because I know it's absolutely filled up with just Lovecraft people.
Yeah.
That does make a huge difference. Yeah. I drove past it and was like, this is the scariest looking hotel I've ever seen in my entire life. I've driven through the middle of the country. I've stayed in places that 100% cockroached, but that looks awful. That's serial killer level.
And that was just the outside. There have been times we walked in there and there would be like a weird rust stain on the wall and a bullet hole around it. I'm like, this looks suspicious.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And the weird part is, it's a whole lot better than it was 10 years ago.
Oh, yes.
Whoa. Oh, my God, you guys. I don't know if I can come back next year.
Well, you know, at some point in your life, you need to stay at the Banfield if you're...
It really is a rite of passage.
Yeah.
All right.
How have you guys been enjoying the festival, though?
Yeah, it's an experience. You know what? It's the Hollywood Theater, which I've never seen a show at. I've actually come through here a few times and been outside of it a few times, but I've never actually gone in. So that's been a real joy to check out the theater. The vendors have been awesome. It looks like they really put on a cool little event here.
Brian and Gwen do great work.
First of all, Brian and Gwen are the loveliest people on the planet. Yeah. I can't say enough about them. Gwen comes by and gives me a hug every time she sees me and just makes me feel good. So thank you, Gwen. But you're seeing literally a tenth of what normally happens at this festival.
Yeah, because it looks... I was actually surprised how full it was considering everything.
It's usually fuller, plus two more screens running, plus what's it, EOD or whatever that's called.
Yeah, they rent out the senior center across the way.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just full of author readings and vendors and stuff like that. So you're constantly traveling across the street and doing stuff and seeing stuff. And it's a big, huge production. And the world has changed and they changed with it. I'm really glad that they were able to do something in person. Last year it was streaming only.
Yeah.
And they're doing streaming next weekend if you want to check out some Lovecraft shorts.
Right, which at the time of you hearing this episode will be tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday.
Yep.
I will say the thing I think that impressed me the most about this so far is the audience and the kind of people who are coming here too.
Scumbags.
Lovely scumbags. Well, at one point, I think it was Gwen who got on the stage and said, how many, raise your hand if you backed with a Kickstarter. And I swear pretty much everyone, but maybe five people, and I was one of them, had not backed it. I was like, oh my God.
This is a film festival because of its limited space that sells out.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. They sell out normally quite easily.
Yeah.
And have for many years. Mm-hmm. It's so specific and it's such a direct concept that the people it attracts come from all over the country and they come every year. So there's a lot of people that you see again and again and again, and there's hanging out afterwards. And
yeah,
that's where a lot of the neatness of it comes in, because it's just, because, you know, it's still a film festival. Film festival opinions on the movie are going to be divergent, shall we say?
Yes.
Varied.
I mean, all film festivals have, even the best film festivals, even Sundance, you know, like, has a variety of films, some of which people walk out of. So,
yeah.
There was a movie yesterday that I won't name the title of, but I didn't finish it, but I gave it 90 minutes of my life. And I wanted to stand up and say, has anybody here heard of 3-act structure?
You wouldn't have been wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
No. As somebody who sat through the last 10 minutes of it, that was something.
My thinking was, I've given this 90 minutes. I'm finishing this goddamn thing, just hoping. And then it didn't even finish the story of the book or the short story, whatever length is.
Yeah. Right. Which is weird. I don't know. I feel like some filmmakers, especially when you're early into your career, get really artsy and think that you're being profound, but you're really just not telling concise, interesting stories. Mm-hmm. And I was definitely one of those when I started. So
it kind of bothered me. Eric and we have discussed this with you, Vanessa. Eric and I made a film for about $30,000 that we're not particularly happy with, but now we're like, God, what we could do with $30,000 now in today's technology. And the film we are discussing right now, that had a budget. There was a lot of money spent on that. And I'm just like, boy, this needed another pass on the script or some different ideas or something. But a ton of money went into that. And I just don't know how they get that back.
Wow.
Yeah, they won't.
There's no way. And that's the other sad thing about watching people who enter the film industry early on and think that they can, either through their short films or through a feature, make their money back. And I'm like, oh no, you don't understand how this works at all. Do you? if you spent your own money, it's gone. You're not seeing that again.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good times, huh?
Yeah. All right. So
that's
very
the
dark
episode. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, hard done.
don't join the film industry.
I wanted to talk to you about a series that I just finished you just finished, and Eric did not finish, but has said he's okay with spoilers on everything.
I've got I think I'm 10 minutes into the last episode, so.
Okay. We're talking Midnight Mass, and we're talking spoilers on Midnight Mass. How long did it take you to realize this was a vampire story?
Oh my God. Probably the first or second episode.
Really? That quickly?
Well, because as soon as the animals started disappearing, that cat thing.
Yeah.
I was pretty sure at that cat thing.
Wow.
Damn. That's impressive.
It is impressive. It took me with the Monsignor going into the cave and then being attacked by the actual vampire from a Gustave Doré painting to realize, oh, is this a vampire show?
Isn't that crazy? It's like, it's got a real Salem Slot feel to it.
It really does. Oh, yeah. You can clearly see that Flanagan is a King fan, and even his original stuff feels like King stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. He needs to do more. I want him to do some more direct adaptations, see what he does with, there's so many King things that, with as many King stuff has been made, there's still shitload that hasn't.
Oh, for sure. Or could be redone.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I think the King is like, hey, please do another thing of mine. But at some point, Flanagan has got to be like, I have my own ideas also.
This is what this was.
Yeah,
right.
This is all his
writing.
But again, King's influence is blindingly obvious.
I think we were talking about Revival, his film that never got made, that's based on Stephen King's book. Mm-hmm. And there's some ideas from that are very similar to Revival, and I think they must have come from his script adaptation of that book.
Right. Yeah.
So I really enjoyed it. I think that it flubbed a little bit at the end.
Really?
I still think it's the best ending he's ever had.
For sure. Well, I agree to that. I think that the ending I was extremely happy because it actually kind of ended in a way that felt satisfying.
Yeah.
But what was the flub, do you think?
Oh, there's the whole thing of the vampire that's feeding the you know, the vampire king, I guess you would call him, mm-hmm. that's feeding and can't be bothered to react to bullets being shot into it, which is just foreshadowing so they could show the scene at the end where she cuts its wings and it doesn't notice.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is ridiculous. If you're an animal feeding and somebody shoots at you, you're going to react immediately to this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think the biggest flub was that it's a vampire story and no one there knows what a vampire is. And has ever heard of one slash understands how they function.
But here was the brilliance of this was making it so that everybody could walk around in the light and everything. That immediately tells you as a film goer, they can't be vampires.
True.
Even though that didn't happen until, Nosferatu in 1922. So.
Yeah. I will. This show deeply affected me. I am deeply in love with it. And I think the reason is... I can connect to it on so many levels because it's about an island, which is something I grew up on. So when they're like, got to get the boat for the mainland and the weird, quirky people who live out there and the one drunk guy that everyone knows is the drunk guy and everyone knows the history of, that's very, very island life. And then the Catholicism mixed in, the guy who plays that Monsignor is an incredible actor. I tried to look up like what he'd been in before because he seemed so familiar and he really hasn't starred in anything that I could see. And he just nailed that feeling of a priest who's very, very sincere and passionate, but also tone deaf.
Yeah.
So, oh my God.
Eric, weren't you saying he was from Friday Night Lights or something?
No, that was the younger guy, the alcoholic.
Oh, okay.
Prison. Yeah.
Who was also, I mean, I got to say, the acting in this was fantastic for
everybody.
Even when
Flanagan is, stories are weaker, the performances are always freaking amazing.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And the monologues, I mean, just like that last episode, there were two moments in it that completely summed up my feelings on religion. It was eerie. Like it was completely eerie at one point when the sheriff is doing that Bible quote when he gets shot in the leg. When I was in eighth grade at Catholic school, we had to pick out a quote from the Bible for graduation. And I was a bit of a rebel. And so I picked the quote about that exact same fucking quote. Cause I was like, I know what the next line is. It's about being rained on equally for the rich and the poor and the good and the bad alike. I was like, yes, fucking yes. And about being stardust and being just pieces of some greater universal whole. I was like, that's literally how I feel about everything. And I've had all of these arguments, everything that they're hitting upon here about how religion is so toxic in so many ways. I was just like, I've literally experienced this moment. It really resonated with me. And I realized that it probably didn't with everybody, but goddamn.
The main lady that was helping him out.
Bev.
The super religious lady.
Yeah.
I grew up with so many people like that in my town because I was basically raised non-denominational and they can't handle that.
No.
There are several strong, obviously large Mormon contingent where I grew up. And there's also a lot of Christian Catholic. And I had teachers that tried to convince me that I need to come up with a religion, even if my parents don't think I should and all this kind of shit.
That's fucking crazy. And
she was so like... I can think of three people in my junior high to high school years that were just like her that I had to deal with.
You know, and the crazy thing is, so on the island I grew up on, the biggest, there's a lot of churches for 300 people. The biggest one was a very specific version of Christian. And I grew up Catholic and I was one of four or five Catholic people on the island. And they basically called me a freak. So even when you have a specific denomination, mm-hmm. you still don't have the right version of God. Right.
Yeah, you've got to get whatever that version is.
I was called a Mary lover. and basically treated like I was a cultist. They're like, you got statues and stained glass and shit, weirdo. I'm like, well,
okay.
All right. Sure. Calm down, you Mary lover.
Hey, man, she never, did a lot of shit.
Never heard that term before, but I was also raised non-denominational, and I guess I was very lucky. Grew up in a very liberal little town up in, up in Bellingham, Washington.
Yeah, right. That does make sense, yeah.
I didn't get all of the horrible shit.
You know, it's just so, it's everywhere. It seeps into so, as soon as you organize your religion and you tell people how to pray and how to think and how to believe, and if you don't do it that way, you're wrong, then we're all fucked.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's wild because watching, what was the play that Trey and Parker did, the Mormon?
Oh, the Book of Mormon.
The Book of Mormon, yeah. I remember seeing that play and everybody around me like cracking up and reacting to it. I'm going, well, this is just
how it is.
Accurate. I mean, the Mormons fought against it, and then it came out, and now you go to see it, and there's ads for Mormonism in the program.
Oh, my God.
Because it is actually incredibly accurate.
Wow. That is unreal. That is unreal.
Today on a very special...
It really does
strange
feel like
odds.
We're all coming out in this intimate setting in this hotel room.
We had a couple of Mormon kids in our neighborhood, and... all I remember was they were just the nicest family on the block.
So. Yeah. Our neighbors are Mormon and they are so good to my family, and they've treated us. I mean, they've done more for my mom than almost anyone else on earth. So
that's nice.
Yeah. They're good people.
Well, they can be good people.
They can.
Let's get that out there.
Yes. As any religious people can, there are people who can be good people out there on earth.
Other things that have happened is we've got a voodoo donut box right here.
Yeah, voodoo. I mean, we're in Portland. What? When in Portland?
I guess so. Thank you very much.
Was this one of your first trips to voodoo? Or?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Not at all. But my boyfriend is along for the ride, and he had never been to voodoo. And so I was like, yes, we have to go buy a lot of donuts and have one bite of all of them, as is my way.
Oh, all right. So,
the tapas of donuts, if you will. So
you have a donut flight I could get?
Basically, could you just give me a donut hole of every single one of these? Because that would be my dream. Absolutely. I love sharing voodoo with people, and I don't know that they are the best donuts.
I would say that they are not the best donuts, but they certainly have a an aesthetic.
They do. Yeah. They do.
Their box here, their pink box, with the slogan "Good things come in pink boxes." That's such a Portland thing to do,
right? Yes.
Yeah,
with like the very Louisiana style skull art on it. Mm-hmm.
Vanessa delivered donuts to us last night at the Moon and Sixpence, which is a Irish bar we hang out with, and thankfully, then you joined and had drinks with the group of people that were there. So that was cool.
Yeah, it was super fun. I mean, you guys included me in your lives, and that's what friends do. They show up at midnight at English pub with a box of donuts.
That is an Irish pub. Do not get us thrown out of this state.
Yes, is it? Yep. When I Googled it, it said English pub on it.
Did it? Oh, yeah. They say like bangers and mash and sausage rolls. And
I mean, those are English foods.
Yeah, that's true.
But whatever, it's cool.
Irish, I guess it's Irish over here,
right?
But somebody who's actually been,
I'm like, yeah, those are, you're knows, just saying like, English foods to me.
Dumbass.
Unless it's a Scottish, well, I guess that's Scottish, Irish. I mean, there's usually a lot more cabbage involved.
Good point. Yes, maybe they're just smarter in their menu selection. Oh. No haggis, no cabbage.
Mm.
And then separately, we all went to Powell Books, the city of books, which is a block-wide, several-story-high building full of books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've loved in the past going to Powell's, and I have usually frequented their graphic novel section.
Yeah.
And this time it was fairly a miserable experience.
Oh, no.
It was just so full of people. Like, the graphic novel section was, it was like, you know, 10 people deep in a pretty small aisle. And I was like, you know what? Not worth it. I'm not going to worry. I'm going to go over and find, I've started dabbling back into writing. And so it went to the writer's section. It was like, what books do you have on writing? It was completely abandoned. No one was down there. It was across from the romance. So
yeah. I went to the movie section. That's usually where I end up going, movie books. And I found some good stuff. But it was crowded and oddly warm.
It was hot. So I was like, it's hot in there.
Yeah. Well, the sun is coming right through those southern facing windows. Yeah. But I'll get a little pervy here. Because I also went to the graphic novel section.
Yeah.
And you young nerds don't know how good you've got it. There were so many attractive young women going through the comic books there. Let me tell you, in the 80s, that's not how it was.
Oh, I am sure. Also, we are on the West Coast. And the people who, the women who are frequenting these aisles are very different than what you might find in like the South.
Good point.
Yeah. So I know a lot of very lonely nerds in the South and the Midwest who are like, where are the ladies? I hear that they like nerd stuff. Where are they? I'm like, we have them all in Seattle.
All in the Northwest.
Yeah. And then finally, you were invited, Vanessa, but you decided to turn it down. Andrew Migliori, who is the original founder of the film festival, is taking Eric and I and a couple other people to a private tour of a whiskey and gin distillery today in Portland.
Nice.
Sounds god-awful.
It's going to be so much fun. Next time you see me, I'm going to be just my arm around you. Vanessa, I love you.
That's been like almost every other moment of this festival.
And that's why I'm the driver.
You know, I'm so stoked for you guys, and it's going to be great. And if they had even vodka tasting or water tasting, if they had anything other than gin and whiskey, but you know, like a fun version of it, I would be in. But unfortunately, you know what? You guys have a good time.
We will have a good time. Andrew made sure to let us know that they are not open on Sundays. They are open on Sunday today for us.
That's so cool.
So
that's so cool, guys. Yeah. You're going to have such
Andrew's
a good time.
Obnoxiously awesome in many, many ways.
Yeah. He really is. And we got to see some other friends. Aaron and Leah showed up. Yeah. Leah, you remember, bought me the weighted blanket in my time of need and all that. And they were not going to come here. And then suddenly texted me and said, hey, we're swinging by just to hang out with some people at the bar. And that was neat to see.
Cool. It has been so wonderful to meet more people and people who listen to the show too, which I'm always surprised every time it happens. Because Leah was like, it's so weird to talk to you. I'm so used to just listening to you. I was just like, oh, weird. Thank you.
Yeah. There's those moments. Like I remember having it also with like Facebook posts or something years ago where somebody comments on something you've said here and you go, I think you mentioned this too. It's like, oh yeah, this actually goes out and people do actually listen to us. Oh, that's so cool.
I'm always amazed that anybody listens to this show.
Yes, exactly.
What is wrong with you people?
Don't you have better things to do?
No,
like laundry?
No, this is so much better.
This is the best thing you can be doing this moment. Thanks for listening, Mom.
My mom too, thank you.
And Kelly's mom.
You know, speaking of the description of the last episode was Eric brings COVID to his coworkers. My mom texts me.
Oh no.
She says, I haven't listened to the episode, but what is this about Eric bringing COVID to you guys? Like, Mom, it was a joke.
It's fine. Everyone's fine. Everyone's healthy.
We're all vaxxed. Right. Relax.
We're all good. Yes. Hey, nice rhyme, huh?
Yeah.
Vaxxed. Relax.
So, well, we do have a regular topic we're discussing, but why don't we take a little break and we'll come back and we're going to be talking about, well, I guess it was my pick to do cosmic horror.
Sure.
All right.
Come to the beautiful Isle of Green,
the land of liquid emeralds.
Cascades of sparkling droplets.
Liquid Prell.
The beautiful Isle of Green. Liquid Prell's extra rich formula bursts into torrents.
Billowy lather.
Leaves hair.
Radiant.
Shimmery.
Luxuriously clean.
Come to the beautiful Isle of Green
and know the luxury that Liquid Prell can give you.
We have returned from whatever groovy old commercial Eric has popped into our feet.
Bow wow.
This was this was my subgenre pick, and because we are down here for the Lovecraft Film Festival, I thought it would be neat to do something that was along those lines. So cosmic horror or weird horror or anything. Didn't have to be Lovecraftian necessarily. But with that in mind, I chose from 2016, The Void.
Haven't you ever wished to save someone beyond saving? No matter what the cost. This is uncharted territory. The body has to adjust, of course. We weren't built for this kind of thing. You'd be surprised at the things you find.
Something calling them all here.
What if those people get in here? What are we supposed to do?
You saw it? What was that?
Do you know where you go when you die? I do.
So you're familiar with this?
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I was unbelievably excited when I saw the trailer. Tell us more.
Budget. I could find no information, but I do know that $83,000 of it was raised from Indiegogo, which they used on their effects. The box office was $368,372 worldwide.
Specific?
Yep. Rotten Tomatoes. The critics have it at 77%. The audience has it at 47%. Yeah, it was written and directed by both Jeremy Gillespie, who's mostly a first assistant art director on shows like Lock and Key, The Boys, It, The Shape of Water, Star Trek Discovery, and the best show on television, Hannibal.
That's not on television anymore. It's so good. It's been canceled for a long time.
And hey, if you're done shitting all over the best show on
the
TV.
Show I've never seen.
Same.
And it was also written and directed by Stephen Kostansky, who directed Manborg, Leprechaun Returns, and Psycho Gorman.
Boy, the difference in status of those two lists is really impressive.
Well, this guy has continued directing. The other guy is assistant art director on a bunch of huge shows that are just continuing on. That's not so bad a career.
No, that's pretty good.
Extremely, extremely good stuff.
It stars Aaron Poole, who has 84 credits, including Spiral, that latest Saw, the book of Saw.
Oh, sure, yeah.
The Empty Man.
Oh,
and yeah. American Gods, and also stars Daniel Fathers, who was in Pontypool, Orphan Black, and Dark Matter. Kathleen Monroe, who's been in The Dresden Files, Haven, Alphas, and The Car, Road to Revenge. Ellen Wong, who has been in Glow, Dark Matter, and was Knives Chow in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World.
Oh, sure.
Mick Bysock, who is in The Magicians, Supergirl, The X-Files, The 100, Supernatural, iZombie. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that he lives in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
So.
And then finally, Art Hindle, 184 credits, 7 that are completed and in production right now. You might recognize him from Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the 78 version, The Brood, Millennium. He's a very, very familiar character actor.
Mm.
Okay, you have both seen this film.
Yes.
Correct.
And I'm going to guess most of our listeners have seen this film too, but I wanted to give myself a second viewing on it because I didn't like it when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I liked it more this time.
Oh, that's okay, good. Cool.
So it starts with a man fleeing from a farmhouse and escaping into the woods, and then right behind him, a screaming woman who is trying to follow, but is then shot down by these two guys that come out of the house that she's in. Lying on the ground, they walk up to her, douse her with gasoline, and set her on fire. That is the opening scene, and it is pretty intense.
Yeah, yeah. Opened well.
Then we meet Deputy Sheriff Daniel Carter, who is on duty sitting in his patrol car when he sees the man who had just escaped crawling out of the woods right in front of him. Seems very unlikely that this would coincidentally lead out onto the small country road he's hiding on, but that's what's going on. And he grabs him, rushes him to the local hospital. And this is where the budget of the film starts showing up. The local hospital is short-staffed because it has been damaged by a fire just recently. I was like, oh, yeah, that's kind of creative way to try and explain why we're only seeing one hallway, one room, and three people on staff.
I forgot they had an excuse for that.
Yes. So it's a skeleton crew of nurses, a doctor, and a few patients, including a pregnant young girl and her grandfather. By the way, Daniel Carter, his estranged wife, Allison, works there as a nurse, so that complicates things a little bit. This is where everything starts happening. So Daniel walks in on a man who's been in the hospital already to find that the nurse, and everybody, this is a small town, so everybody knows each other. So he knows the nurse who he sees murdering the patient.
Oh, wow.
And she has flayed her own face of skin, and then she starts walking towards him with a scalpel, and it's somebody he knows. I think her name is Beverly, and he keeps, you know, he's pointing his gun at her and saying, "Beverly, drop the scalpel," and all this shit. And then he has to shoot her. And so he's very, very troubled by this.
Sure.
So a state trooper shows up, and that's Art Hindle. And he is there to collect the man that the deputy had found crawling on the side of the road. And that is because he has discovered the bloody scene at the farmhouse with the woman that was set on fire and all of that stuff. And there's a really uncomfortable scene where the trooper is dressing him down for letting this whole situation go to shit. Because he's come there, now there's a nurse dead, she has killed her patient, and all this shit. And this trooper is just like, what the fuck kind of town are you running here? So Daniel goes outside to call in the nurse's death from his patrol car, but is then confronted by a robed cultist. And it's a very basic-looking kind of cult robe with a hood that covers the face and then a black triangle in the middle of the face. And for how basic it is, it's very effective. It's really creepy looking. Mm-hmm. And this guy basically rushes him and stabs him. He manages to escape back into the hospital, but as he's looking back behind him, the entire hospital is now surrounded by all these cultists. And I'm watching this going, now, why didn't I like this? This is starting off really strong, and it's giving off a really cool Prince of Darkness vibe. Mm-hmm. We can talk a little bit about that, because Prince of Darkness is not a film that I love. But there's so much of it that I do like. I think I'm angry at it for the way it kind of goes. Yeah. And I feel like this kind of idea would have made a much better Prince of Darkness idea.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I always thought of it more as an Assault on Precinct 13 vibe.
Which Prince of Darkness also has, though.
Yes, yeah. So if you kind of, exactly, if you kind of combine the best moments of both of those things, you get a pretty solid...
Yeah, I agree.
Pretty solid movie.
So, Daniel and the two guys who had burned the lady at the beginning, they had come in also, and they've basically kind of taken the hospital hostage, and they're going to kill the man that he had found crawling on the road. So there's something going on where everybody's kind of ending up at this hospital. The cultists now apparently know something's going on here. The two men who want to kill the man, and then the man himself.
The man is here.
The man.
The dude.
Well, they walk into the room where he's handcuffed, and they find that the nurse that he had killed has turned into this pretty gruesome tentacly monster thing that's expanding and looking pretty cool. This is where the film starts to fall apart.
Ha-ha.
There we are.
It's the script writing, unfortunately, because the effects look great for the most part. The camera work in this is really nice, and the actors are all doing a pretty decent job, but the script now then has them... they decide to add conflict by making everybody angry at each other. So there's now just a bunch of people yelling at each other, which is like a real rookie move in writing. It's like, well, how do I escalate things? Well, everyone's got a gun and everyone's angry. And so we'll just start yelling. And I was like, okay, you guys, you've got a bunch of cultists outside. Yeah. You've got a monster inside. And that is enough conflict. Yeah. We can have people talking and saying, all right, what do we do? We're kind of fucked. It turns into a siege movie like we were talking about. But the interesting part is that the cultists don't want in. They want to make sure that nobody gets out. And that's the Prince of Darkness kind of siege that they've got going on.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So from there, it turns into all sorts of gruesome shit. There's reanimated corpses and hideous monsters that are totally a love letter to John Carpenter. The effects they're going for are very Rob Bottin, The Thing effect, stuff like that. But what we really find out is that the real point of all of this is that the young girl who is pregnant is now going to be giving birth to something.
Dun, dun, dun.
But we're not exactly sure what. And the other part where this movie falters is that they decide, I love the idea of not telling us what's going on and making us live in the moment and being as confused as everybody there. You know, because the temptation is to have a villain then start spouting exposition so the audience can catch up on what's going on. Well, they don't do that. So now you're like, well, but I do want to know what's going on. So you get a little lost. The girl who was pregnant, I don't really understand what happens to her. But now Daniel's estranged wife is pregnant with the creature instead.
Yeah, I remember being extremely confused by everything involving that pregnancy.
Yes. There's a triangle-shaped portal to somewhere, the void, I assume. Although we see what's in it later, and it's not a void, so take that for what it's worth. there is a lot of really great Lovecraftian and cosmic horror here. It feels very much to me like Prince of Darkness, and quite honestly, it works for me better than that movie did, because the failing of Prince of Darkness, I think, is that once the people inside start getting possessed, it turns into kind of a slasher movie, and it's just that he's just hunting down one person after another, and I was like, oh, this was so cool, and now it's kind of basic, and this one never goes that route. So what I really would love is these guys to get a nice budget and for them to get the chance to remake Prince of Darkness and just mix that movie with this movie and make it scary all the way through.
Yeah.
A little bit of trivia. The writers of the film say they were inspired by Guillermo del Toro, who was working on At the Mountains of Madness, which we all know never happened.
Oh, yeah. Man. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oof.
And he made a comment about wanting to do Lovecraft, but in a way that no one had envisioned or seen before. So they were doing, one of them was working with Guillermo in like the art department, and the other guy was like at the studio doing something else, and they both came together and were like, oh, why don't we do that? Let's do Lovecraft like nobody's seen before. Gillespie and Kostansky managed to crowdfund the money they needed to build the practical creatures that appear on screen. Other assistance came from the team working on David Ayer's Suicide Squad, which was shooting in Toronto. Gillespie served as assistant art director and Kostansky as a makeup effects artist on that film, which led to members of the special effects team on Suicide Squad to work on The Void. Gillespie later declared The Void as a difficult production, noting that every single thing was the biggest challenge. It was a soul-crushing nightmare.
Oh, wow.
Jesus.
Everybody was pushed to the limit on this movie. The one ray of hope we got was the cast, which came together at the last second. They were very easy to deal with.
Wow.
Well, that's good.
Unusual.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The filmmakers say they intentionally leave the Black Pyramid and much of the cult a mystery for viewers to use their own imaginations and create their own explanations and theories. Thanks, fuckers.
Yeah, the best.
You did us no favors. There's a magazine in Toronto called Now. And Now magazine found that the directors were still operating in their referential comfort zone, with the film being a savvy mashup of at least four John Carpenter pictures.
Oh, wow.
And that it was still its own entity, an effective, resourceful nightmare that convinces you the apocalypse is clawing just out of sight beyond the edge of the screen. I think that's pretty accurate. I agree with it. The 47% really kind of shocks me, because at the very least, you should be on board with this because of the practical effects and the intent of the filmmakers to not go, you know, CGI.
Yeah. I kind of get it, though. As somebody who paid $7 or something and wants it back still. If you guys could go ahead and just send that on over to me, send it over to Strange Aliens Radio. I'll
there you go.
Happily yeah. take it. Because the effects, I remember, it's been a while, but were fucking phenomenal.
Yeah.
The trailer was fucking unreal. Yeah. So good. But when it came to the storytelling, which some of us like, some of us do in fact enjoy a story of any kind, it was so lacking, not only in the script, but in the way that it was shot. I remember there were so many medium shots that I had no idea what room I was in,
yeah.
who was in the room, where we were going, why we were there, what they were reacting to. I never understood and I never felt connected in the right moments at the right time because of what shots were being chosen to be seen. And it just, the way the story was projected just through, I don't know if it was the shooting or the editing, infuriated me.
Extra syllable.
So many, so much infuriation that I had to put in an extra, like, you are in there for good measure.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, it felt like they loved a lot of movies and they paid tribute to a lot of movies. And I don't know where their idea was. At times, I felt like I wanted them to do something a little bit different, or at least tell us what the different thing they were doing was. And you saying things like, she was the granddaughter, the pregnant girl in the beginning. I never figured out who the guy was. I was like, is that like her sugar daddy? Like, who is this dude, bro? Maybe they said it, but I remember not knowing and being like, this is a creepy couple. I don't know what their relationship is, but like, don't know.
It is dropped in, but she calls him grandpa or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's exactly how I felt on first viewing. And so I'm really glad I gave myself this second viewing because I ended up liking it quite a bit more, even if I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. And I do wonder if now that you're talking about it, I wonder if after seeing stuff like Malignant and starting to get a little bit more patience for filmmakers and understanding the process and the difficulties. And I do love special effects a lot more than I used to. I wonder if my opinion would be a little bit,
get
a little
you
bit
past
nicer.
Your film school.
Yeah. My nose initial in the air film thing. School. I'm so fucking smart.
I've only seen it once and I do remember all the beginning, and I remember a few effects shots, but nothing else in that movie stuck with me at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's because it is not a well-told tale. It's just a really cool set piece, which some cool shit happens in.
Yeah, I'd say give it another try. It's free on Tubi right now, so.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Fantastic. Well, I guess it's my turn.
Yes, it is.
To discuss cosmic horror.
Yes.
I should just go ahead and start by saying I had to Google what cosmic horror was. I was like, does it mean space? Does it mean Lovecraft? Like, what is it really about? And so my takeaway was it's sort of this unseen, almost bordering on existential terror.
Right.
That vibrates through your bones and you don't know why. So that being said, I was so excited by seeing Midnight Mass that one of my Google finds for cosmic horror, best cosmic horror films available, was Absentia.
Danny?
Let's call them lucid dreams that you're having. They started about the time you decided to declare him dead in absentia. You're describing visual, auditory, even tactile hallucination.
He's not the only one, not even close. They declared Walter dead in 2002. I ran into him just last week.
You see me?
Left behind a son who says his dad was taken away by a monster.
It's sleeping.
Go missing in this neighborhood, and those things turn up in one place.
I was seeing things too. They felt so real.
We found a body in the tunnel.
Oh my God.
Always in this neighborhood, you lock the door.
I know how that sounds.
You see your eyes?
We're gonna need to question you a lot more.
I swear to you, I could hear him in the walls.
Yeah!
hey, I know this one.
Yes, very well.
Yes, actually, that was something that came up in my trivia, Eric. So I will make a note of that.
Cool.
That this film's from 2011, and it is a Mike Flanagan joint. Well, first of all, Rotten Tomatoes score 87% critics, 49% audience. Mm-hmm. So audience was meh about it. Budget of $70,000. No box office information that I could find.
Sure.
My guess is that they made their money back in distribution and probably didn't even have like a theater run, really.
I did festivals.
Yeah. Yep. So Mike Flanagan is the guy we were talking about earlier with Midnight Mass. He has also done Hill House, Bly Manor. You would know him from Gerald's Game, Dr. Sleep, Oculus, Hush. And of course, a film I already talked about, Ouija, Origin of Terror, Origin of Evil. This film lands squarely between him doing the Oculus short film in 06. He did this in 11, and then he got to do the feature for Oculus in 13. So this was kind of right before he really had a breakout. He still was a struggling artist. And there's not much of that $70,000. He did a good job with what he had, I will say.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
definitely.
This is starring Katie Parker as Callie. She is kind of our main heroine. She's been in 38 things, including Bly Manor.
good.
Dr. Yeah. Sleep, Hill House. She also was in an episode of Masters of Sex, and she's currently starring in a TV show called Alt. We have Courtney Bell as Trisha, the pregnant one. She mostly does TV bit roles. She was also in Oculus as an auctioneer. Dave Levine as Detective Mallory. So I did handwritten notes this time, guys. I'm not reading off of my laptop.
Yeah, it's wild.
I know, right? Back.
Throwback to you not being able to read your own writing.
I know. Yep. It's a really special. It's a really special feeling. Detective Mallory, who's been in 12 things, including the Oculus short. He was also in the Oculus feature as Robert Clancy. And he's done 22 episodes of Space Something Space. Space Guys in Space. I think it's Space Guys in Space. Morgan Peter Brown as Daniel, who's the guy who's missing. He's been in 58 things. He was in Ouija, the first one, as a grief counselor, lots and lots of shorts, and does a lot of TV day playing. And last but not least, Doug Jones.
Yep.
That was weird. we would all know Doug Jones as being the guy in 171 things. If he is tall and a little weird looking, it's probably Doug Jones. Abe Sapien from Hellboy, the Pale Man / Fauna from Pan's Labyrinth, Saru in DS9, and the Amphibian in Shape of Water. Also, I didn't realize he's the Bye Bye Man in The Bye Bye Man.
I'm not familiar with that one of his.
Isn't Bye Bye Man the thing we all... Oh, wait. No, never mind. I'm sorry. I was thinking of the tall man.
Oh.
Okay. This fact is way less exciting for me now. Oh, no. I'm sad. Okay. So the story of this is we start off with a very pregnant woman putting up some missing person posters. This is Trisha. We're not really sure why she's pregnant. We don't know a lot about... I mean, okay, we know why she's pregnant, but she has a husband who has been missing, and it turns out he's been missing for 7 years. So this pregnancy is a little like, okay, this is interesting.
A long time to be pregnant.
Yeah. I was like, he's only been missing for like 6 months, right? And they're like, well, we're going to file a missing a death certificate because he's been missing 7 years. And I was like, does anyone want to mention the baby in the room? It's fine.
Baby in the womb. Am I right?
Oh, hey.
I'll see myself out.
Door's right there.
She is met up with by her sort of wayward slash prodigal sister, Callie, who comes into town to help her out, to kind of help her move out of her old apartment, put her stuff together, move on with her life. Callie was seems to be a drug addict, and she'd also been living on the streets and just bumping around for a long time, but she's gotten her shit together. She found Christianity, and now she's available to help her sister out. So the word absentia comes from the death certificate as the cause of death. It's written there as in absentia. So there are a couple of things that are a little bit weird. Trisha is having a lot of strange dreams / waking nightmares of her husband as this sort of zombie ghost thing who's super fucking pissed. He's doing a lot of that, like, that Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Donald Sutherland, mouth wide open, a gasp, screaming into the air at nothing at her, and his mouth is black and his eyes are black and his skin is white, and he just pops up all over, mm-hmm. which is kind of fun, actually. Like, there's one moment where she's going through her closet and he just fucking pops up and you're like, ah, there's a guy. Or she's like hanging out with her lawyer and it's middle of the day in a nice lawyer's office, and looks over her over the shoulder of the lawyer and he's just standing there. So they do a really effective thing with that, and it's hard to tell what this is, but she keeps seeing him and she's going to therapy and trying to figure out what's going on. In the meantime, Callie, who has her shit together, is running every day. And you can tell she's got her shit together because she's running every day. What a healthy individual. And she starts running through this nearby tunnel. But of course, I think it's like LA. It feels very LA. And there's, you know, weird people. There's a homeless guy seems to be slumped over in the tunnel. It's Doug Jones. And he looks at her and he's like, wait, you can see me? She's like, yeah, sorry, dude, I don't have any money. He's like, wait, no, you can see me. And she's like, I gotta go. Bye. I'll bring you something later. And he's like, tell my son I'm here, blah, 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 blah. And she pieces out. So there's something strange going on. So in the meantime, we also have Detective Mallory, who shows up, even though the husband's been missing for 7 years. Seems that maybe the baby is possibly this detective dude bros, and he's got a thing going with the sister, or the pregnant sister, I should say.
Detective dude bro at your cervix.
You know what? He's doing a good job. He's actually a pretty decent actor. So it's official. The husband is declared dead. She gets her wish. She can start to move on. She's packing up her shit. She gets ready to go on a date with a detective. They're holding hands in public for the first time ever. They're walking out, and who should show up in the middle of the street looking all bloody and gross? The missing husband. Daniel has come back. He is pale. He is skinny. His stomach is filled with animal bones. He tells Callie, the wayward sister, of a strange insect that had him captive in this sort of strange space between the tunnel that she's been running in and the underground, somewhere that's here, but not here at the same time. And maybe this insect is still after him or her.
Is it?
It's hard to say. So the rest of the film is really following around this interesting relationship between this tunnel and this other world. And they're fighting, trying to keep Daniel there. But also, shit gets cray. Insect be hungry, yo. So, I thought this film was pretty good. Yeah. I will say it. It's weird because it's a Flanagan, and just seeing Midnight Mass where there's so much money and this has none.
No money at all.
And he's baby Flanagan. So you're like, oh, honey. Like, there's one moment where they cut we've got Callie. She's picking up a blanket and we cut to a close up and she's holding a book. And I was like, oh, you guys, that's so rookie. That's so sweet. I love it.
$70,000 budget, Vanessa.
That's right. And probably a little bit went to, you know, Doug Jones for his very good, but what, a minute of screen time?
Yeah. They must have done him all in one day. Like,
did him like 2 hours.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, they have two scenes with him in it, so they had to dress him up at least twice, once with a little more blood. So that's pretty exciting. There's also obviously limited locations. There, yeah. You never really see the creature. Although I love what they do with it. There's this strange bug, and they use a mix of sound design and like legs in the foreground.
Yeah.
They kind of shake, like some wiggly thing with legs seems to be being shook in front of the camera occasionally. And you're like, fuck, what was that?
Yes.
Which is extremely effective.
It really works.
You know, I wish, I don't know. I feel like the seams are really that you want to see a little more. You want to see more of what's going on with these homeless people or these people who are going missing in this tunnel. You want to know more about what's happening in this space, and you don't really get that. And I think that's all down to budget. Like I said, it is genuinely creepy considering. I think that all the actors are actually extremely good, and I love that he's building out his Flaniverse.
Right. Motherfucker.
I know. I can't stop saying it.
Yeah, there you go.
Like, why did you do that to yourself? Your name is not worthy of doing that. Anyways, fine. I do think it's interesting. You see a lot of sort of hints of some of the things he's going to look into in the future, like Callie's newfound religion. We just saw a lot of that explored in Midnight Mass. There's these sort of haunting ghosts that are present and seen by some, but not others, which you get in both Hill House and Bly Manor. Oh, yeah. And there's a couple of really good lines. Like Callie comes back from a run at one point. She says, "I smell like an armpit's asshole." Very good. Very good. And like just the way that he explores this idea of fear when Daniel comes back to the world of the living or the now or the here, he's so messed up and he's so freaked out. And often you see actors really like overact this and or underact it and just like are comatose or they're freaking out and yelling and shaking. He does a very good job of like riding this line of quiet but terrified. And at one point, he stops in the street and looks at this tunnel and he just pees himself. And you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
Whoa. Like you can do a lot with very little. As far as trivia goes, this film, I just want to say it did debut at the Fargo Film Festival, but it won Best Feature and Jury Award at Maelstrom.
That is right.
Maelstrom International Fantastic Film Festival.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's submitted, and I remember watching the first few minutes, and the acting starts off oddly rough.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like, oh, well, I'll come back and watch this later. And I don't know if it was you or one of the other judges said, you know, that's directed by the guy who did Oculus.
I'm like,
oh, shit. Okay. I'm going back to watch it right now. I'm not going to worry about it later. And whew, it is so freaking good.
Wow.
Yeah, I tried hard to get him to come up for that year, but he wasn't able to. But
had he only done the Oculus short at that point when the festival
happened?
He had
some other things. Yeah. I tried to get him to send them to me, but he's like, no, they're these weird romantic short things I did, and they're just awful. Like, okay. I'd still like to see him.
I'm trying to remember, was he at Dragon Con with us?
Oh, yeah, he was.
So our film was one of three films that year chosen to show at Dragon Con.
Oh,
and
nice.
The other one was his short Oculus and then something else. But I remember you and I, Eric, watching Oculus and going, motherfucker, this guy in 8 minutes did what we've been trying to do our entire life. It was such a creepy short film.
Yeah. And so smart and so using a budget.
I feel like he was
really
there
well
because
done.
I feel like he told us the plan was to make a feature of Oculus.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it feels like it. Like that was such a smart move. And I think since then, everybody's kind of been like, oh my God, that's so clever. Just make a short film of the feature you want to do, which you can afford. Like you can afford to make a short film and then, you know, sell it around.
Yeah. Generally, that doesn't work. Well, I'd say I know of one situation where it worked as successfully as it is for him. And it's him.
Right.
But
we'll prospect that.
But it worked well for Gigi. She did a couple of really good shorts and then stuff. But I mean, it was great to show that. And he was a lot of fun. He was really easy to work with. And that was really cool. And I remember when Oculus, the film came out, I contacted him, not realizing it was a Blumhouse, you know, because Blumhouse was pretty new still at that point.
Yeah.
I'm going, hey, is there any chance we could show Oculus at MIF? He's like, well, no, there's kind of other plans for that.
Oh,
I was like,
no.
Oh, okay. Yeah, international distribution is already set.
Distribution, man. It can really, it's so frustrating because it's like, but it's a festival. Come on. just throw it our way.
What I love about this and him, as a filmmaker, your short film is your business card. Yeah. And he clearly used that short film to get this very small budget for this feature film, which he then turned around and used as another business card to say, look what I can do for this amount of money. And I don't think that happens as often as we'd like to see it, but it sure worked out right for him.
Yeah.
Watching that, you can see the talent. There are moments in there, like you were talking about the silhouette bug, that still sticks in my head.
Yeah.
And the things he did with sound and stuff, you're going, okay, there's real talent here. Something needs to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, something that really surprised me, but I loved as well. So Kelly, your film was funded by Indiegogo. He actually did run a Kickstarter for this. And he had over 300 donors in 30 days for the pledge drive. He requested 15K and got 25K back when people on Kickstarter actually gave any money towards filmmakers at all. Just now gone. Thanks, Zach Braff, you asshole. A couple of other really small trivia pieces. There's not a lot. The actress Courtney Bell was actually 7 months pregnant when filming. I wonder if, like, I don't understand the pregnancy thing. Like, if he chose that on purpose. Like, they never get super far into it. And I feel like it would be a really nice trigger point he could push a little bit further, especially when the husband shows up. There's, like, one moment where he looks at her and looks at her belly and goes, And she's like, you don't get to fucking say shit. You've been gone 7 years. And I was like, okay, I guess that's that. The mirror hanging on the wall in the psychiatrist's office is the Oculus mirror for the short film. This film features, you were talking earlier about how he is clearly a fan of Stephen King. This short film features Callie reading the Dark Tower comic book. Which I caught a small edge of, and it has like a half price book sticker on it. And it's just like kind of flipping it. Like you can just see the word ARC or like the T and the D and you kind of, I was like, oh, it's a Dark Tower comic, you guys.
Stephen King.
Yeah, enough not to get in trouble. And yeah, that was basically it on this. I wish I could have found a little bit more, but it was fun. It was fun to see. I didn't expect starting with Strange Eons, I didn't expect to like this guy at all. And slowly through this show, I've become a fan, which is weird. Everything about this is weird. Yeah. I was so sure I was going to hate him, but now
big fan.
The Flanniverse is
what one thing that's funny little note on that one. You know, I was still able to communicate with him, which is several years past.
Yeah.
Was when he got distribution for that, the poster they put out was so shitty that he sent like this big email to anybody that was festival that anything that it's anybody that had screened that. And said, you know, if you want to put some more ads out about my movie and put the right poster, that would be great. Because it's terrible. Have you seen that where she's like crawling along on the ground?
And it's totally like a cheapo distribution poster where they hire new people and substitute them for the original actors and put them in weird situations. I've seen this happen to a lot of our friends.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Ugh.
Yeah, that was just terrible. The original poster was this neat kind of all green with a silhouette in that tunnel. I was like, well, that's perfect.
Yeah, it was very minimalist, exorcist-type looking poster.
Oh, all the poor guy. All the images that I came across was the girl in the tunnel, or the crawling girl that was probably not the main girl.
Nah, I'm pretty sure it wasn't.
It was some rando.
Nice choice.
Yeah,
that's fun. Really good. It's a great choice for topics. So Eric, what did you end up falling upon?
Well, in another nice way that we seem to do several times, we're getting three very different eras of films. I went all the way back to, I didn't write the year down. Remember what year the Haunted Palace is, like late
61 or 62?
Early 60s, late 50s, yeah. So the Haunted Palace, I'll say 1961.
You are invited to an open house where horror will be your host. The Haunted Palace. You who find a kind of macabre hideousness and the horrifying, will enjoy yourselves as in ecstasy in The Haunted Palace, starring Vincent Price, a being who lived and died and lives again.
I'll not have my fill of revenge until this village is a graveyard.
And intriguing Deborah Padgett, whose appealing beauty inflames the blood of the bloodless.
Charles, please.
Well, I've been very busy, but I'm back now.
Charles.
We have the whole night before.
His violent, torturous passions inflict both pain and terror. Lon Chaney, carrying on a family tradition of masterful motion picture horror, while the strange and feared new master of the Haunted Palace reaches for the skeleton of one long dead.
You see? He's taken her mind, her soul,
just like the others.
Really, this is outrageous. Surely, after all these years, I'm entitled to a few small amusements.
Sure. With Vincent Price, so that just clears it all out. Currently available through Scream Factory or Paramount Plus.
Ooh.
The Rotten Tomatoes ratings is 75 from critics, 66 from audience, which, I mean, it's good. Maybe a little low, but, you know, I'm probably prejudiced on thinking of a Vincent Price film. No budget I could find. The box office I did find was listed at $2,616,000, so did well for an AIP release. This was actually directed by Roger Corman, who didn't direct a lot of movies, but he did produce 515 movies.
Oh, my God.
Directed 56 and acted in 43.
See, this is the kind of career that makes Vanessa go, oh, this guy only directed 12 movies.
Yes, good point.
You know what? I'm getting better. I'm learning my lessons.
The writer was the very good Charles Beaumont.
Oh.
Alfred Presents. He's done Turn Backward, two episodes of Thriller, The Premature Burial, 22 episodes of the original Twilight Zone, and two episodes of the 80s revival. Large figure in the Twilight Zone world, and with good reason. And it was also credited from the poem by Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
And the story by H.P. Lovecraft, which is the case of Charles Dexter Ward, more or less. Starring Vincent Price. You know, 210 credits. If you're listening to this show, I'm pretty sure you know who Vincent Price is.
The voice of Thriller.
There you go.
What's Thriller? Who's Vincent Price? I'm sorry, what?
Moving on. Deborah Paget or Paget. I'm not, no idea if the T is pronounced. She plays Anne Ward. She's been in Tales of Terror, The Ten Commandments, From the Earth to the Moon. Apparently she was in a movie with Elvis Presley where he proposed to her.
Of the movie.
Yeah, where she in real life proposed to her. But she was dating Howard Hughes at the time.
Oh my God. So everything about this story is amazing already.
Little Elvis, go away, boy. But if you've ever seen Priscilla Presley,
yeah.
I know exactly why he asked her to marry. They are very, very similar.
He has a type.
So funny. Yes.
Oh.
Oh, I feel so gross.
Also in this movie, we have Lon Chaney Jr. from The Wolfman of Mice and Men and Secret Agent X9. Leo Gordon, who's been in a crap ton of stuff, including the remake of Maverick, the Garbage Pail Kids movie, and lots of TV, plus actually a fair amount of fairly famous films. Alicia Cook Jr., Rosemary's Baby, The Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, A Haunting We Will Go.
I've never heard of that.
I don't either. Hmm. Or Milton Parsons, who is in Kolchak, The Night Stalker, The Ghost of Mrs. Muir, and lots of Dick Tracy movies. The original Dick Tracy. It's so weird watching when you're doing movies that are this old where the actors are in. It's like they're in movies that are you know, 20 years before the 60s. So like, oh, that has great opening credits with the use of a spider making a web and really, really good music. Hey, we do open on the unusual tale of a man who's experimenting in a cold, dark castle, and the local town folk don't like it, so they burn him at the stake, and he curses their family's future.
As you do.
Truly rare moment in filmmaking that you see this storyline opening up. And even more rare, 100-some-odd years later, the people show up, and it's all the same actors.
Like, what?
I know who you're playing.
You look just like your grandfather.
That's right.
Those genes are strong.
It does start in those opening scenes. It's got a lot of the Lovecraft words are dropping. The town is Arkham. The several of the people introduce the, or he calls out several of the people, the crowd, which the names aren't always exactly Lovecraft, but they're similar to Lovecraft characters' names. Then fast forward to the next generations, and he shows up, and they go into the tavern called the Burning Man.
Yes. What a great, I'm opening one right now.
And they get no help from the people. They don't particularly want his family back in town. We don't want your type around here. And as they're leaving, somebody finally says, your place is up here. You need to go there. They leave, and they run across a young woman or young girl who has no eyes and deeply webbed fingers.
Ooh.
Does fast forwarding 100 years put it into present day?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
It's still very gothic.
Right,
very
okay.
Gothic horror. Hmm. I mean, it looks like 100 weeks later, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's like two or three, I think it's 3 or 4 generations.
Does it go from Victoria times to Victoria times?
Yeah, they're pretty
fantastic.
Much,
fantastic.
Yes.
Can't read your own typing
here. Shit, man. What do I write here?
Now I feel way less embarrassed.
Yeah, you should. When he gets into the castle, you can see he starts to get overtaken, shall we say, by the previous owner, Kerwin. Joseph Kerwin is the name of Vincent's ancestor. You know, the painting on the wall, that's exactly him.
Right.
The atmosphere is so well done in this film. It's really just thick and deep. Anne Ward, which is his wife's character name, looks around the dark, glorious, just the look of the house. And Lon Chaney, of course, appears and goes, Jesus, scares the crap out of her. And he is the caretaker of the place. There's some uncomfortable moments where when Kerwin has taken over Vincent's body and is making advances on Vincent's wife. It's like, huh, you're a different person. This just feels a little wrong, but oh well. What you gonna do? You're saying, guys will be guys.
Oh my God.
Luckily, nothing really toward happens. He just sort of advances on her and she's like, fuck off. But as the movie goes on, Kerwin takes over Charles a lot more, and the battle for their souls begins as they go back and forth trying to figure out who is actually going to control him. Price is pretty vile in this. Kerwin is one of his darker characters. He's usually kind of a wink and a smile villain.
Yeah.
And this one, he's just an asshole. And he is really dark. He's trying to bring back his wife, which looks surprisingly like the current wife.
The Kerwins had a type.
Yeah, there you go. Last 15 minutes or so of the movie is wonderful, epic, and the music is amazing. And it is obviously a very famous piece because it stuck in my head for a long time afterwards. And I'd heard it other places and I couldn't place it, but it's fantastic. We have a nice little moment here where Anne is down there with the doctor trying to figure out what's going on. And she comes across the Necronomicon.
Uh-oh.
As you do.
And the guy's like, well, maybe you should leave that alone. She's like, it's only a book. And his reply is, it is much more than a book. The creature at the end that you see is not great.
Yeah.
It sort of looks like it was left over from a creature from the Black Lagoon. It's like, oh, it doesn't quite work. So they do this weird way of shooting it. That works. It helps it a lot. You really can't see what's going on.
Mm.
So then you've got to go watch the movie. Because this is good. This is a really solid entry, one of Vincent's good films. You know, he did a lot of movies.
I remember really liking this, but it's been so long that I just remember very little of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's similar enough in tone and look to a whole lot of films that he was in that's pretty easy to do.
Right.
And I was like, well, so was that The Pit and the Pendulum, or was that some other movie he did? The trivia and notes, we've got the tagline. Another all-new masterpiece of terror from Edgar Allan Poe.
Finally.
Edgar Allan Poe's name is misspelled twice in the opening credits.
Oh my God. What?
And then correctly at the end.
They must have done the Allen part incorrectly. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Apparently the sets, though, as spectacular as they look, were very small. And just the lighting and the shooting of it made everything look huge. Especially the basement where they're doing the sacrifice just looks gigantic, but it wasn't.
I feel like that era had like masterful lighting that was happening on a lot of films.
Yeah, this does. This is beautiful. I mentioned the music earlier is Ronald Stein who did that. He also did music for The Terror, Dementia 13, Frankenstein's Great Aunt Tilly.
What?
What? Wait, Great Aunt Tilly?
Yeah, I don't know.
Wow. Okay. I had an Aunt Tilly.
Oh, Tilly okay. Frankenstein?
Was she?
I don't remember. No, I think it was Pfeffer.
She was more of an all right than a great aunt.
She's just a so-so aunt.
So it does say it's a Edgar Allan Poe movie, and this was entirely financial because it was the third in what would be Roger Corman's Edgar Allan Poe films, but it is actually an adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft, Case of Charles Dexter Ward. This is the first screen credit to H.P. Lovecraft.
Whoa!
Ever in film.
Wow.
And it is also the first reference to Necronomicon, first time it's shown on screen. Might have been referenced. I think it's been referenced before, but it's the first time. Hey, look, it's a book. And the title is borrowed from a six stanza poem by Poe, is what The Haunted Palace
Short.
Is. Yes. Published in 1939. But was also used in The Fall of the House of Usher. They use 8 lines from the poem. And that's how it's an Edgar Allan Poe movie.
Wow.
Wow.
In the book, Lurker in the Lobby, A Guide to the Cinema of H.P. Lovecraft, written by John Strykosick and Andrew Migliori.
Who's that? I don't know who that is.
I think we've heard of Andrew.
We'll be drinking whiskey with him in a few short
exactly.
hours.
Exactly. What he wrote about this, The Haunted Palace is a seminal film for Lovecraft lovers. It is the first major motion picture to introduce Lovecraft and the Necronomicon, and the wording, at least, of cosmic abominations, Cthulhu and Yog-Sothoth to a general audience. Lovecraft's obsession with the past is clearly presented in a heartfelt passage at the end of the film. So is his belief that mankind is a minor species adrift in a malevolent universe. The film strikes a good balance between narrative and action, and Vincent Price is, well, priceless. Hey, there you go, Andrew.
Beautiful.
The supporting cast is solid, and the art direction by Daniel Holler is really quite good for a fairly low-budget film. Which I say is like they did such a great job of making it look huge. Roger Corman did an admirable job as the first American feature film director to stake out cinematic high ground for the cosmos crushing adaptations of H.P. Lovecraft to follow.
Very nice.
So they like it's actually the first movie in the book.
Oh, okay.
It's like, oh, well. Because, you know, I saw that. Of course, I have a copy. Are we in that one? Is that the one that the shorts? Because we're in one of their books. Unfortunately, the film misquotes Lovecraft in some of the descriptions from about the Elder Gods and the Dark Ones. But what are you going to do?
Does it say? Do they say strange eons in there anywhere?
Not that I heard.
Ooh.
Yeah. the quote they have there is the Elder Gods, the Dark Ones from beyond. Once held ruler of the world, but now are merely waiting for an opportunity to regain that control. It's not so much Lovecraft, but it's more August Derleth, who's a disciple of Lovecraft, who probably is the reason we all know of Lovecraft, but also is not a great human being.
Right.
Let's see. Completed. Oh, April 1963. There we go.
Ah, 63.
the only film teaming Vincent Price and Lon Chaney Jr. other than, I like that. I read that and going, and then it says other than Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, I forgot Vincent Price was in that.
Yep. And the lead lady that Elvis proposed to, Paget, retired from this after this film and became a born-again Christian, hosted her own show, An Interlude, with Deborah Paget, and on the Trinity Broadcasting Network in the early 90s, and also was involved in Praise the Lord, occasionally appearing on TBN as a guest.
Oh, my God. I hope they rolled that footage out at every opportunity. We just found this piece of a film that you were in. Let's show it for the audience. So I think I only have one question. So they attributed the film to Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm. Did they ever say in the credits H.P. Lovecraft?
Yes.
Okay, they do.
Yes,
all right. Yes, yes. All right, cool.
His first film credit.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was a sneaky, it was a credit, but not a credit.
Oh, yeah.
It's all Poe. Everyone knows Poe. Don't worry about the other guy. Nothing to do with people you don't know.
Well, another nice choice.
Yeah.
Good job, guys.
Wow. It's really good. All of these are, I think, really good ways to crack into October as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Speaking of cracking into October, Eric, I think you've got the pick for the next movie.
I believe I do. How about we do comedy horror?
Okay.
Do a...
This sounds spontaneous.
Yes, that's right. Something for the fun of the October season to get you in the mood.
Ooh, I like this.
I like that. It doesn't have to be straight out comedy.
Or... Yeah, no, it doesn't have to be Tucker and Dale or
right. Okay.
Anything like that. It can be something whose lends largely to the comedy concept as opposed to, well, this one guy said a funny line.
Yeah.
Because I always have that.
Yeah. I think I don't really like comedy films for the most part, so this is going to be a fun challenge for me.
I happen to love comedy films, and I've already got one tucked away in my foreskin.
Oh, nice. Never mind. I was going to say nice, but I don't want to anymore.
Nope. I hope you bleep that so my mom doesn't get angry and send me a text.
Oh, man. That may have to be the post.
No, please.
Double down on that.
She's going to be so bad.
Okay. This is the part where I say thank you to everyone who's participating in the value for value model, who's liking and sharing posts, who's doing reaching out and suggesting things for us. It's been, just overwhelming the response we get to all of this stuff.
Yep.
Can't thank you enough. And then here we are, Lovecraft Film Festival. We'll be signing out now, but back in 1 week, back in the regular studios. It'll probably sound a little better than this.
I hope so.
Less refrigerator, that's for sure. And people in hallway.
Oop. And cars outside and us holding our microphones and all the weird sounds you probably heard.
Yeah. At least they didn't fill up the ice like they did at, 5:30 in the morning?
Right.
fill up the ice thing while we're doing this.
Did they call you guys at 9 a.m. this morning?
No.
They called me to ask whether or not I wanted my room cleaned because they do limited service on the weekend. I was I'm not ready for the phone right now. It's too fucking early. I cannot live a hotel life.
All right, you guys. Well, you've completely derailed my sign out. So,
I'd like to thank all the people that are taking part in the value.
That's right. Guess what? Let me just be the first to say, I will see you next week.
Ah.
Bye.
Our show is recorded somewhere high above Naval Station Everett at the nexus of all realities and is engineered and produced by Eric Margaret. Our theme music is Strange Eons Part 1 by the band Nightshade and is used with permission. Find Strange Eons Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and wherever fine podcasts are found.
Thanks, Zach Braff, you asshole.